Welcome to Geared for Growth. I'm your host, Mike Mortlock, Managing Director of MCG Quantity Surveyors. Today, we're turning the spotlight to the Brisbane property market, and we're talking to local guru Simon Clark from Settler. What we're focusing in on specifically on this one is where he sees there being some great value for investors with the price differential between houses and units in some of Brisbane's blue chip suburbs. We have a chat to him about that, what people need to know when they're buying in those areas, and where he sees opportunities for investors at some of those more modest price points. It's an awesome interview with Simon. I know you'll enjoy this one. Here's Simon.
Simon Clark, thanks for joining me on Geared for Growth.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Looking forward to having a chat.
It's been a couple of months in the making, this one, and obviously I've known you for quite some time, so I'm looking forward to delivering this baby, which we're going to call The Shifting Sands of Investor Behavior. A bit of a mouthful on a birth certificate, but thankfully the baby is just a metaphor, and we're talking about property. You shared some insights before we started recording about how investors seemed to be targeting houses a couple of years ago. Townhouses have been perennially popular. We've seen that in our data. It's actually probably the biggest exploding kind of type of house from an investor selection point of view. But you're now kind of seeing units as having the potential. Now, first, I want to give you the opportunity to define unit, because often people talk about a good type of unit that is a good investment type of property, and then there's also the nasty ones.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think, if you look back to 2021, I'm obviously based in Brisbane. Obviously, I'm based in Brisbane. We only buy in Brisbane. So I guess I'm coming from the Brisbane market perspective. But you look back in, post-COVID 21, clearly house prices took off in Brisbane, and there was a lot of catching up to do. The market did that, and it's obviously continued on somewhat since then. I felt like 2022 into 23 was really the townhouse, as you mentioned, your data would have picked up.
Yeah.
I remember talking internally, it's the year of the townhouse, and you could see, townhouses, as people got priced out of houses, move into the townhouse space. What we're seeing now, and I mean, a prime example is we were at an auction just last week, and there were 16 registered bidders for a unit. Now, when I talk unit, Mike, I'm talking 70s, 80s, possibly into the 90s, that sort of brick, almost tsunami-proof type of, dwelling.
Yep.
Usually a 4, 5, 6 pack. That's about it. Maybe an 8 pack, which is 8 individual dwellings, I guess, on a considerable piece of land, usually 600 to 800 square metres, possibly 1,200 square metres piece of land. In a city, there's a place for the high density, I get it, but that's more, for me, I think more of an owner-occupier type, they can buy those. But I'm more interested in, from an investment point of view, those smaller dwellings, because usually they're larger in size internally.
Yep.
Whilst they might have one bathroom, the bedrooms and living areas are larger. Usually the body corporates are low, and ultimately the good ones, I think the good opportunities are in those inner city blue chip suburbs. Where there is access to amenity and transport and lifestyle and schools in Brisbane, that sort of inner ring of Brisbane. There's particular suburbs in particular, I think, where where density is capped also. So you're usually at only 2 or 3 levels, density is capped. That's the type of asset I'm talking about.
So no flammable cladding, no gyms, no 26 level lifts and strata fees that would put hair on your hairs. We're talking about these bomb proof sort of post war units, where not only are they a little bit bigger than some of the apartment high density shoeboxes, but you've also got the advantage of your share of the land as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, land's what appreciates, obviously. So, and in these areas, there's some nice green space. There's typically, it's not pools and these sort of things, but it's usually some green space. The old Hills Hoist. Often you see a Hills Hoist in the yard there, and There's no lifts in them. There's usually, sometimes it's even two-way stairs. They have two doors. They have the two-way stairs. One's a fire exit, one's the actual entrance. So, but they're just, you know, you know, you walk around these buildings and they're built in the 1780s. You don't see, you know, most of them you don't see a crack in them. They're so solid. They're not built like they are today where you hear all these problems. So they're so solid. They usually have a nice aspect. The balcony is usually built to a really nice aspect as well. And you're only sharing with a handful of people. So body corporates are usually much lower than what you see in those density projects. So, yeah.
And one thing that you've really observed, which I think speaks to a fire under the backside of capital growth for these types of units, is the price differential between a house and this type of unit in the suburbs where we're focusing on. Which would you say these are blue chip suburbs where you can actually buy in at a fraction of the cost of a house, but it still has a tremendous amount of livability and desirability?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, not all suburbs I would advise, particularly in Brisbane, to buy this type of asset. What we're looking for is a real that spread, where the spread between the house price and the unit is, let's just, for example, greater than $1 million. You know, your median house price might be, you know, in Balmoral, for example, is 1.8 million, but your unit price is circa 600,000. So the spread is, there's a, you know, $1.2 million gap there at the moment. And ultimately, that wealth effect, that inner city wealth effect, where, you know, people's children, family, friends, they want to live close to their family, so they want to live in a city as well. So, they're in high demand, and we're seeing this at open homes. So, I think there's really good opportunity for growth. They're already growing. Trust me, they've probably grown 10% or more in the last 12 months. You could pick these things up, you know, for $300,000 or $400,000 only 2 or 3 years ago. And we're now probably in the sixes. So the growth is
painful to hear.
Absolutely. And I think there's, you know, you look at places like, you know, probably in Melbourne and Sydney, would have already happened, particularly Sydney. You look at, you know, those Vaucluses and the Woollahras and those inner city blue chip suburbs where the wealthy live, these small units that were built in the 70s and 80s, the prices are, you know, astronomical now. So, whilst Brisbane's not Sydney, the same effect is happening.
Yeah. And so when it comes to scarcity for these types of unit purchases, there's no land releases, right? Because these are inner city areas, but there is potentially the ability to sort of go up, or are there quite tight planning controls to stop super high density apartments going into these locations? Like, is there a threat to supply?
Well, I actually bought a block of units for an investor client of mine recently in the inner city suburb of Windsor on the north side of Brisbane. And a good example of that is we purchased this particular block because it was within a few hundred metres of a major bus depot. You could actually, it was an old 80s block or 70s, 80s block, six pack, you could actually raise this to three levels because it's close enough to a major transport hub. But literally 200 meters down the road, there's another block where that couldn't be done. It's because it's what they call LMR 2 and 3 zoned. But to get to the three levels, there has to be certain boxes ticked, right? So that particular site could be redeveloped, and this particular client would potentially redevelop that down the track. But, you know, as I said, 100 or 200 metres down the road, it wasn't close enough to that major transport hub, so they couldn't redevelop this particular one. So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of them are usually two levels, and it's very difficult, even if they were demolished, to get a third level on them. So that really caps that, I guess, that any sort of density upside, you know, density happening or more density happening down the track. So, yeah, you've got to be really selective. And I think ultimately there are, even I'm talking units, sometimes they don't, they're not scarce enough. They might be on a main road and have a lot of road noise. That for me is a no-no. Like, I'd want to be on a quieter street, for example, or get a view, or sometimes they have double car parks. It needs to be some sort of scarcity pizza even attached to that I think for an investor to be really strategic, that it might be the one unique unit in that particular block. It's a corner, so it gets extra light. So those things I'd be taking into consideration as well when I'm looking to invest.
It sort of begs the question, given that there's currently a political debate about housing affordability, rental affordability, you know, we've got a huge influx of international migration. And, you know, the government's trying to build 1.2 million homes in 5 years. That when we've got these tight planning controls, you know, it seems like there would be federal pressure for this. But is there a fairly strong not in my backyard movement in Brisbane that's sort of de-risking some of these places for investors?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think everyone's happy for development, but just not in their backyard. Basically, I mean, and I think, you know, when you think about the, you know, these areas, you know, if you're in a city listening to this and you think about those areas, typically, you know, those people are quite influential, they live in these areas and can influence government, and they want to protect their areas. And yeah, build density, but three suburbs or four suburbs away. I think there might be older sites that weren't necessarily apartment sites in the past. They could have been a commercial site that gets rezoned for development.
Yep.
That can happen, and there's probably a bit more density attached to that. But, yep, you know, that can also bring some amenity and cafes and parklands, and there's typically a whole caveat that those developers need to go on to develop those sites in terms of criteria they need to meet, which actually adds value potentially to the area.
Yep.
But yeah, these smaller sites, very much protected in terms of density, and yeah, it's not in my backyard is certainly you see it on the Facebook groups and all over the place. Yeah.
Now, if you wouldn't mind, catch us up to speed on Brisbane, because if I cast my mind back as far as it'll probably go in its understanding of Brisbane, I remember reading in the media like Brisbane's going to boom for probably 5 or 6 years, and it did absolutely nothing. People were talking about, well, the price differential between Sydney and Brisbane or Melbourne and Brisbane is just so big that it has to happen. Yet nothing happened for a long, long time, and there was probably a good decade seemingly where prices were fairly stagnant. And then we actually had Brisbane really being the big beneficiary of the pandemic, I suppose, in many ways. Minimal lockdowns was one of them, but also interstate migration. Everyone, especially Victorian, thought, you know, it's great being in prison for a year, but what I'd actually like is to be free and in the sunshine. So Brisbane had a great run, and then the market sort of seemed to stop for a little while, and it actually had a second kick that I certainly didn't quite see coming myself. Where are we up to in the cycle, and do you still see value for investors in the long-term fundamentals for Brisbane?
The Geared for Growth Property Investing podcast is presented by our business, MCG Quantity Surveyors. If you're an investor or a property professional looking to get the best tax depreciation deductions for yourself or your clients, please get in touch with us at mcgqs.com.au. It's our mission to help as many property investors as we can to maximise their claims and maximise their property education as well.
Look, I'm obviously... I was born in Victoria and lived in Melbourne to, you know, I was a country boy, but lived in Melbourne in my early 20s and travelled overseas. In my 30s, lived in Sydney, and my 40s, I've lived here in Brisbane. So I've probably got a bit of a unique, not that I'm across those markets per se, but I've lived in those cities, so you sort of understand the demographic and I guess the city itself. And to your point earlier, yeah, I felt like Brisbane was constipated for a long time. It needed a really good laxative. And it got that laxative in COVID, and prices took off. But probably what was really holding it back was the economic conditions around Queensland. Like if you think through that period that you spoke about, you know, economically Queensland, Brisbane wasn't performing very well. Now, everything's cyclical. You look at Melbourne now, and Melbourne's probably feeling the effects of that, or Victoria / Melbourne. Economically, it's probably in a bit of a challenging position right now. The market's certainly been more subdued. But I'm sure that'll flip around in 4 or 5 years' time, and everyone's like, "Oh, Melbourne's taking off." So, from a Brisbane perspective, where I see the market right now, I still think, yeah, I guess there is a bias because I live here, and but ultimately, I think there's still really good value, particularly in that unit space I spoke about from an investment point of view.
Yep.
Houses in a city, you know, I think people sometimes hear sort of, wow, that's $2 million. And I look at it and go, well, that'd be five or six in another city or two cities here in Australia. So it's still, I think there's, we're still getting, definitely getting inquiry of people looking to relocate here. In fact, quite a few of our buyers recently have been buying, renting it out for 2 or 3 years and then planning on moving here. And the reason they're doing that is they can see the market still got momentum, still going at a rapid rate. So they want to get into the market so that they're not feeling outpriced in 2 or 3 years' time, put a tenant in place and then move here. So, yeah, I think, look, you know, you've obviously, the Olympics is not the be-all and end-all, but it certainly puts a focus on the city, both domestically and internationally. And that puts pressure on, I guess, federal and state governments to, you know, add infrastructure into the Southeast Queensland area, particularly Brisbane, where hosting the Olympics. So I think that bodes really well long term. And there's obviously a bit of a hiccup there with the stadium at the moment. I'm not sure if you read, but Gabba was getting, you know, refurbished, then it was getting demolished, and they're building in Vic Park. Now they're doing nothing. They're sort of, oh no, we're not going to do anything. But that might change again. I mean, that's one government at a time. They're still 8 years away. There's plenty of time for that to change. So, yeah, look, in short, I think there's still good opportunities here. Yes.
Yep. And so for investors that are looking to Brisbane to transact, what do you think people need to know if they're from, say, Sydney or Melbourne or Adelaide, and they're wanting to get a slice of this growth and these long-term fundamentals? What, give us the lay of the land and some of the do's and don'ts.
Well, I think, you know, if you're looking to buy here and you want to buy well, having access to, and that's probably the challenging part if you're coming from a standing start, access to agent relationships. Agents, because listings are so low at the moment, I mean, in some parts of Brisbane, I've been looking at the metrics and, you know, they might normally have 50 sales in the first 3 months of the year. There's only been 10, right? So listings are really low. And I think you'll see that data come out shortly from the major data sharers that listings are again on the decline in Brisbane. That might be Australia-wide, but I'm seeing it here.
Yep.
So what we're seeing is if people are looking to sell, they're often selling with more round terms. So you need to be, I guess, in the know to get access to those opportunities, either pre or off market. So I think that's really important to getting a good buying opportunity, is that there are a number of properties transacting before they hit the market, I guess is what I'm alluding to. Obviously, the obvious one's the flood. Now, there's the flood mapping debt that's been updated recently by the Brisbane City Council, which are a little more scary for people. So you need to be across that because, you know, buy a bargain, sell a bargain, as I say. Like people go, oh, that looks cheap. It's for a reason. We get rung all the time. Oh, look at this one. And you look at it, that seems cheap. Then you look at floods, a beautiful little wave of water go through it only 12, 18 months ago. Yeah. So, you know, waterfront. Things like... Waterfront, yeah.
Yeah.
At times.
Water views.
Water views.
You can drive your kayak right up to the front door.
Yeah. And other things like, I think this is, you know, that I'm a big advocate for, you know, if you, as I said, you can buy well, but if you buy a bargain, often you're going to sell a bargain. It might be on a main road. You know, again, that for me is a no-no. It might be, you know, the unit at the front of the block that gets considerable road noise. So, again, that's a no-no. So, you know, being across those things. And then from a rental perspective, because, you know, investors are, you're finding your rents are still on the way up. They're sort of mapping upwards in that northerly trajectory, which is, you know, good for an investor. So units we're still seeing typically in these smaller blocks that I'm talking about, almost 5%, sometimes more than 5% yield.
Right.
So that, but again, not all, you know, I guess equal. So you need to be aiming for that sort of yield. Probably three or four things that I'd be wanting to check off my list before potentially buying something here in Brisbane.
Mm. Excellent advice. I want to change topic a little bit for investors that are looking. I mean, obviously, you've shared the value of a buyer's agent, right? Those off-market opportunities, and just because they're off-market doesn't mean they're good, right? But the relationships, relationships are really, really important. And you're quite an unashamedly sort of boutique buyer's agent. You would rather have a higher fee and deliver a higher value service than being more of a volume play. And I just wanted to ask a question on behalf of investors. You know, where do you see some potential conflicts with your fiduciary responsibility and contrasting that to some of these more high volume buyer's agents? Because I suppose, to me, when I read Freakonomics, it sort of made me realize that everything's all about incentives, and the incentive for a buyer's agent is to do the deal, right? Like, there might be an upfront cost, but you know, to get the full amount paid to you, you need to transact. But you know, is there a point where the transaction can be kind of compromised by the incentive to get that done if you are needing to get 20, 30, 40 done a year? Do you see that as a problematic thing about the buyer's industry space?
Yeah, I think if your listeners are looking to engage a buyer's agent, for me, there's a couple of things, and not everyone's going to agree with this, but I think ultimately, if you're looking to buy in Brisbane, I'd want someone on the ground in Brisbane. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's, you want them on the ground here. You want them, you know, part of some organisations that are reputable, setting standards, you know, organisations like the REOQ and REBA, for example. I think, you know, reputable buyer's agents are part of those organisations because they do go through your process to make sure you're doing things properly. Using a Form 6, for example, you know, you'd be contravening the Act if you're not signing a Form 6 as a client of a buyer's agent to make sure that you're being protected as well as the buyer's agent's being protected. So there are probably two or three things. Obviously, insurance is in place. And then further that, really making sure that you're not, if you're going to use a buyer's agent, your brief is not being conflicted amongst other buyers within that agency, because then that becomes really challenging. Like, how do you make sure you're actually getting the best option and not the sloppy seconds because you came to the party late? So I think that would certainly be a question I'd be asking a buyer's agent, you know. Is my brief unique to you at the moment? And that would be the only brief you have in this space to make sure you are getting the service. And then it's the level of service that you're after. Like, some people probably want less service and less touch points, and they're more about the fee, as in the buyer.
Yep.
For us, we're very high service levels, high touch points, high communication, high level of detail. Hence, you know, our fee can be, it's certainly not the lower end. It's probably not the top end where some buyer's agents might be, but we think it's fair. And certainly our buyers do, because they've used our service sometimes multiple times and referred their family and friends on. So there are probably a few things, if you're a buyer out there looking to potentially engage a buyer's agent, that I'd be sort of cross-checking with, you know, some other things that are important to you.
Yeah, I love that. And I think sometimes people in a particular industry can take things for granted as knowledge that everyone has. And it's only because I spend a bit of time in and around buyer's agents that I've understood this competing brief thing. So if someone has $650,000 and they want to buy a unit in New Farm, just making that up, I don't think that's probably enough money. But
You might get one better. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. But you might have 10 people at once that are happy to pay you to find that. But then it's like, well, who are you working for? Who comes first? You know, how does that kind of work? And as far as I understand it, you know, most BAs will just not take on someone that is competing in a certain way. Or if they have two separate briefs and one changes where it tends to overlap with the other, then they sort of raise that as a conflict to say, well, if you do cross over that brief, then you are in second position because that person was very clear on that and they started first and blah, blah, blah. Is that sort of the normal way that it's best handled?
Well, I think your quality buyers agents, yeah, absolutely, where their values align with your values as a buyer and they've got your best interests at heart. I mean, they're there to represent you, the buyer, right? So I guess the waters get muddy because a real estate agent on the sell side, they might have multiple listings. Obviously, they usually patch and they might have, you know, three houses that are $3 million for sale at one time, right? So on the sell side, it happens quite a bit. But on the buyer's agency side, I think that would be certainly a question I'd be posing to the buyer's agent you're interviewing or discussing or brief with, and making sure that, you know, and there's not, they're not trying to look after one person's trying to look after 10 or 15 buyers at once, because I'm telling you, the service will come down. I think a handful of buyers at any one time for one buyer's agent and some support is probably enough for them to be looking after to ensure you get the quality of service and advice that you require as a client.
Yeah, awesome. Now, Simon, I'm going to set you a bit of a challenge to finish this episode off. In our recent data, the average amount that property investors in the residential space are spending is around about $660,000. Now, you can either say, that's not enough money to buy what I consider a Simon Clark blue-chipped asset in Brisbane, or take that money and describe what's the sort of thing that you would be buying with that amount of budget.
Oh, going back to the start of our conversation, for me right now, if you've got $650,000 and you're looking at the Brisbane market, and this is tough for some people to get their head around, don't get me wrong, because they might have a past bias on units, but I think a blue chip inner city unit, let's call it a suburb like Bulimba or Cooperoo, for example, where your median house price is almost triple what you're paying for the unit, makes a lot of sense. You get a really good quality of tenant, usually, you know, inner city, good professionals earning good incomes, want to be close to the city, want to be close to the action, potentially family. So you're getting a really good tenant profile, which you wouldn't get, you know, you could potentially buy a house in a really outlying area of Brisbane, 40, 50, 60K from Brisbane, but your tenant profile is going to be quite different, right? Very different. And I guess to put a client at ease, you're going to get a really good quality tenant. And ultimately, I think the capital growth opportunities in both those, you know, they're both going to grow at some point. And I don't think that house 50K is going to smash a blue chip in a city unit in terms of growth. So we're certainly not seeing that at the moment. Like, those units are really, they're sought after. I was just mentioned to you earlier, I went to an auction the other night and there were 16 registered people at the auction, you know, and all of them, this is the challenge, pretty much all of them in that instance were owner-occupiers, which I think is great. If you're an investor, you want to be in a market where there's lots of owner-occupiers, right? Mm. Because that means that ultimately when you resell, you've got a really good, healthy buyer pool that's emotionally going to, you know, want to buy your place. That was, and they're all in the room. That was interesting. There was one phone bidder, 15 in the room.
Yeah, wow. Gosh. Yeah. And so 650 is enough to get it done? Or could we?
Yeah.
It's 550. Let's push it. At what point do you think stops being value?
I think 550, you're pushing the boundaries. You're probably pushing the boundaries because you'd need some leftover to do some renovations potentially. Yep. That'll be, you know, that's probably 50 years original. Potentially, depending on the suburb. But I think you're probably closer to six and upwards from there.
And by the sounds of the market, it also depends on when this episode comes out.
is true. Although I think, you know, 2024 is pretty safe to say that it'll be the year of the unit in Brisbane. And I think the data will tell us that as the year goes on.
Beautiful. The year of the unit. I love it. Simon, it's been a pleasure picking your brain on all things investor behavior in and around Brisbane. And we look forward to celebrating the year of the unit at the end of the year as kicking those capital growth goals. Thanks very much for joining me today. It's a pleasure.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me. Thanks for our chat.
Cheers.
See you soon. Cheers, mate.